I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Eileen Marnie. Welcome, Eileen.
Thank you. Hello.
Well, here we are in the west end of Fremantle. This isn't your home, Eileen. Not really. Well, it sort of is. Tell our listeners why you're here.
Well, I'm here because I first arrived in Fremantle for the America's Cup in 1987 as a traveller. I was a young woman of about 25 years old. And I then went home to England, London. Then I moved out here and became a resident and lived in Perth for a couple of years. And then in 1990, I decided I wanted to go home.
You mean to London?
And I went back to London and I've lived my whole life in London until I retired from teaching. And now I've got into the habit of coming out here in our winter, which is apparently called wintering. And I come to Fremantle and see my old friends from the 1980s and new friends that I've made at the tennis club here and various other new friends, and that's why I'm here.
But Eileen, you have to tell our listeners a bit more than that. You were a teacher. No doubt you were used to projecting your voice to naughty kids not paying attention in class, but you decided to use those skills to project to an audience. When did this happen and what did happen?
Well, it is literally something that just happened, because I was still teaching. It was about 3 years ago and I was in my very last term of teaching before I retired slightly early. And I was literally clearing my loft at home.
What's a loft?
Okay, so you don't say lofts, right? Attic?
An attic?
A space in the roof. So it's very common in England to have a space in your roof where you just store stuff. And quite often,
and forget
you store
about
rubbish.
It.
Yeah, yeah. And lots of mine had been up there for a quarter of a century, actually, because my dad died and I'd taken boxes from the family home that nobody else wanted. And I just put them up there. So I started clearing this stuff. Now, it took a very long time. It was very stressful, very physically demanding, very emotional. And several weeks into this project, I came down the ladder of the loft and I said to my husband, because we are very regular goers of the Edinburgh Fringe in Scotland, so every year we go to the Edinburgh Fringe as audience members.
As audience.
Yeah, and I just said to him, I'm going to make an Edinburgh show about clearing this loft. It's just so stressful. And I did. I just did.
Brilliant idea.
Yeah, and it all
now
just
I
happened.
Confide in our audience that I've seen this show. What was it called?
Loft Clearance.
Loft Clearance. And you performed it here in Fremantle about this time last year.
I did. I performed both of them, didn't I? I performed it 2 years ago in Fremantle and this time last year at the Frio Club. And I was at the Perth Fringe last year doing it in Dadda.
So there are two involving all of this business.
Yes.
The first one was loft clearance.
Yep.
The second one was?
Loft luggage.
I think it was loft luggage that I saw.
You saw both.
I saw both.
You fell asleep.
I fell asleep.
No, you did see both.
That's not true, audience. You would not fall asleep. And we'll get to the latest one you're doing at the Fremantle Park Club, but it's called Darling Darling.
It is.
Not to be confused with Darling Darling, a fabulous bar here in Fremantle, just down the road from where we're sitting right now.
No, definitely to be confused with Darling Darling.
So you decided, knowing all about the Edinburgh Fringe, to turn this emotional and physical exercise in clearing the loft into a Fringe show.
It just happened just like that. I mean, the thing was, I'd been going to the Fringe for 20 years, so I knew the venues that I would like to look for. I was lucky enough to have enough money to hire a venue, because performing at the Fringe in Edinburgh and probably all around the world is all about having money. It's about nothing else. So you don't make money. You don't make money. Nobody makes money.
But you enhance your reputation.
Well, the best you can do is cover costs. So I was lucky enough to be in a position to be able to do that. So I just contacted an organisation that I knew would suit my show, It's called Spoken Word. It's not very well known out here. You could say it's storytelling, but it's a genre called Spoken Word. And I just got paid for a venue, went up there, and it went down very well. I mean, you can't get big audiences, but
it's the Edinburgh Fringe. Mm. To be able to say I performed at the Edinburgh Fringe is something. So what year was your first performance at Edinburgh?
2023, and I've done 3 Edinburghs now, and I'm booked in for this year as well, so it'd be my 4th.
And just remind our audience, when does the Edinburgh Fringe happen?
In August.
Yes.
3 weeks of August, which is our summer.
Yes. So tell me a little bit about it. I mean, had you done some acting or had you done some writing in a creative sense before this inspiration hit you?
I'd never done any acting, and I couldn't act, I'm sure, but I...
You're very good at it.
No, basically, everything you see when I perform, I've learned everything through teaching. Nobody understands how amazing teachers are. I know it sounds like a... But they
highly,
really are.
Highly performative.
Well, the thing is, when you're teaching, you're performing, really. So I'm not fazed by audiences at all. I'm used to talking to a crowd. And then the writing, I had done writing in the sense I've published some books, self-published some books over the years. So I've got 4 books. So I had done writing. I've always just been interested in that. It's just a hobby. So I've just continued my hobby. So I've written shows.
It does seem like a natural progression of your career and your interest in writing to come up with a script to turn it into a theatrical performance and yourself, one-woman show, perform it. But tell our listeners about your 4 self-published books.
Oh, right. Well, one of them's a short novel. It's based in the First World War. I could spend a long time talking about that one, but anyway, to cut it short, when it was the centenary of the First World War, which was in 2014 to 2018, in England, the Daily Telegraph, a newspaper, was publishing every day online for free. It was publishing the paper that had come out in paper form 100 years previously.
So you were able to live, in a sense, in real time, what was happening 100 years ago.
Because you couldn't get it until the day and the date, so you could actually be living 100 years ago, and every day I'd go in to look at it. And I started getting interested in the personal columns, and in those days, the personal column was on the front page of the newspaper. Can you believe it? A big broadsheet, front page. You'd have people advertising rooms to rent, people looking for a lost bangle or a stray dog gone missing or something. Amazing. And because it was First World War, they were putting in obituaries of their sons who died in the war. And I picked out this obituary and it had an address, Cumberland Mansions. And that became my novel, Cumberland Mansions.
The following books?
After that, I did a children's book about travelling around Vietnam called The Plane Has Standing Room Only, because I actually was on a plane where people were standing in the aisle, because like on a bus.
Not allowed to do that.
No, but in those days, that was in the 90s, actually. So that
starts to reflect your travels, and we'll sort of get to Australia again. The third book?
The third book is... In Pursuit, Moments in Time, which is a selection of travel stories. There's 9 of them, so there's 9 chapters. They're all in different places, mostly different countries, travelling through Asia and Australia. There's some Australian stories in there. And they were from the 1980s. But I wrote them in 1999 from memory of my travels in the 80s and early 90s. And then I put them in a drawer for 20 years. And 20 years later, I found them. I thought, oh, I'll publish these.
Just a half dozen years ago.
So I got them in printed form in 2019, having put them in a drawer in 1999.
Yes. And the last book?
Oh, now I'm a bit stuck. What's my 4th book? Oh, yes. This is The Road Twice Travelled. So I went to
Not
a mountain.
Not the road, but the rose.
The road.
Oh, the road twice travelled.
The road twice travelled. I went to a mountain village in Java in 1985. It was my first experience of real Asia. I'd been to Hong Kong before, but this was real mountain village, Java, Indonesia, and a friend was setting up a hydroelectric plant, and I went to stay with him. And then in 2023, I went back there with him. And it's the story of that. Basically, the villagers remembered me because nobody goes there.
Wow. Now, Eileen, where were you born and where did you grow up? Where were you formed?
I grew up in London. My whole life is London. I'm a Londoner.
So what was it that sparked this creative side of you and the travel side of you? And when did you first venture out of London into these other parts of the world?
Well, it's interesting because I didn't actually get on an aeroplane till I was 19 years old. I'd never flown. And I went on my own to Hong Kong because I had a friend from school in London who was an expat child, and she'd moved with her family to Hong Kong. So I went to stay with her family, and that started it. And then after that, in the 80s, it was quite normal for people who were at university to just have a year off after uni, not necessarily a gap year, or even travelling through the summer holidays, which were 2 months long.
Yes.
So it just came from that, really.
And what drew you to Australia when you came?
It was kind of, I did have an uncle in Brisbane. And I'd had a housemate in London who was from Sydney. And also it was quite normal for people to go through that trail through Southeast Asia and into Australia. It was called... Yes. It was Southeast Asia on a Shoestring. Do you remember that book? Lonely
Yes.
Planet Guide.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was just...
Everyone was doing it, yeah. And you had to visit the colonies, of course.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah. So I started off in Brisbane, stayed with my family, and I taught out in the bush for quite some time. I spent 10 weeks in a place called Alpurrurulam, which is also called Lake Nash, which is the most isolated school in the Northern Territory. So I was there for 10 weeks. I was a couple of weeks in Utopia, which is much nearer to Alice Springs. I taught in Alice Springs, which I loved. I loved Alice Springs. I kind of gravitated to this sort of more natural places in Australia. And then when I arrived for the America's Cup, and I still remember to this day, that was 1987, I just thought, this place has the best climate in the whole world.
You're
and it does,
about,
I still think that.
Fremantle in Indian Ocean.
I still think that.
Well, it's you now sort of been here, you say, wintering for some time. You've brought your fringe shows here, and we'll talk more about them, but what is it? What is it about Fremantle? What is in the air?
Well, Fremantle, it's because there's old buildings, so the Federation buildings, I think you call them. That's a big, big deal about it. Beautiful beaches. What I call the sapphire sky and the turquoise ocean.
Yes.
You might take... I don't know if people take it for granted here. They probably don't. But it's... To a Londoner's eyes, it's just amazing. The light, the heat... It's very, very chilled. I particularly like the bit South Terrace bit where you've got Gold Street and all those. I love that because it's got a bit of bustle about it and independent shops, and you can walk everywhere or cycle. You can walk to the beach, you walk to the hospital if you're not well. You can walk everywhere. It's amazing because I don't like cars. I'm an anti-car person.
In city town planning these days, or for some time, the concept of being able to walk to places within 15 or so minutes is prevalent, and you can certainly do that around most buses. But the bus system's not too bad.
Buses are great. I take the buses all over the place, yeah. And the train up into, beautiful train ride up into Perth.
The train ride to Perth is well worth taking. There are places you can stop and have fun along the way.
I don't know why anyone would drive. You go along, the train goes along the coast, most beautiful view of the ocean. Yeah, it's great, and they run on time, and it's fab. It's cheap compared to London. It's very cheap travelling on transport here.
Let's come back to your fringe shows. The first one, Loft Clearance.
Yeah.
Just give us a thumbnail picture if you were to sit down and watch this today. Tell the listeners what happens, if you like, you've given us a little account of it, but just...
Okay, I'll tell them the story of going up into my loft. I use some video and audio stuff on a screen, and I've got props, stuff that I've found in my loft. And I just go through the story of the things I found and the stories that were behind those things.
It's a bit of a show and tell.
It's a show and tell, and it's very much a family history. And it deals with the difference between hoarding and collecting, because some people think they're the same thing, and they're not at all. And it's basically the thing about Swedish death clearance, where you get to a certain age, and in Sweden you clear things so your children don't have to. In England, we don't do that.
The death clearing.
We leave it.
Yeah, I haven't got to mine yet, but I need to start doing it some thought.
Yeah, well, you should have got it to it at 60, according to...
Oh, is that Swedes, right? It's yes. a bit early. But there's some lovely things that come out, I think. Some of your father's... He was a cricket fan.
He was, yeah, and he had a pile of MCC cards. So one thing I regret getting rid of. I sold a lot of stuff when I cleared, but I did keep the first and last of those. And then his cricket stumps I kept. Strangely, I got rid of his cards that took up no space at all, but I kept the cricket stumps. Ridiculous.
So then the next show comes along, and it's no longer the Loft Clearance, but...
Loft Luggage. Now, this is a take. You'd have to be a train traveller to understand Loft Luggage, because it's a take on lost luggage. So where you go and find, you know, there's a place you can go where all the lost luggage is kept that's been on trains and just been left. It could also be left luggage, you know, if you've left your luggage somewhere, or those places you can actually pay to leave your luggage for a day so you're not carrying it around. But it's loft luggage because I found it in my loft and it's the luggage of my life. You'd call it baggage, really. But loft luggage sounded better because it's...
A bit like finding, in the old days, your parents' or your grandparents' little shoebox full of old black and white photographs.
Photos are a big deal, yeah. So loft luggage was about retirement. It was about what do you do when you stop working? And having retired myself and having a lot of friends, obviously, around my age, I have discovered that work is an unhealthily... important thing for people, and I do use the word unhealthily. They don't know what to do if they don't do their job, and also what you get from being the person of the job you do. So I am a teacher, I am a high court judge, whatever. In England, people seem to connect themselves to their job, because we actually do say, I am a teacher, I am a nurse. Now, I met someone from Norway many years ago. She said, why do you say this? She says, we say, I work as a nurse, I work as a teacher, and that's healthy.
Isn't that healthy? I mean, it's a big issue, I suspect, everywhere, certainly in Australia and certainly amongst people I know. There are people who are both lost at the thought of retirement and then are lost in the act of retirement. They're not sure what to do with themselves. They have to go back to what it was they were doing or try and find something. And yes, work seems to define us.
Yes, it does. And my loft luggage actually had six boxes, and each box was a section of my life. So I sectioned life into six phases. And in each phase, there was a box with only... I only allowed myself one thing. One thing in the box. And... actually, I've got to think back now. There was one object and there was one thought, I think, that I could have. No, one memory, that's right. And a place. A place, a memory and an object in each box.
It was very effective, and I can remember watching that show and thinking about how you, in a sense, philosophized about how life is organized. I mean, one thing, particularly your first book about 100 years ago, the war, and here are all this stuff, and here we are today. I mean, I'm not sure that I believe that time exists. And when you do something like write your book, I mean, 100 years ago, war, and here we are today. I mean, really, you can click your finger and here we are. But you've got a new one, Darling, Darling. And what can you give us any inkling? I'm going to encourage all the listeners to go out and book their tickets. The link will be there. And come and see Eileen perform this.
Well, Darling, Darling... does start in Darling Darling Bar in Fremantle. In my own mind, it's a poetic license, I suppose, and it starts with my story and my relationship with Australia and my problem really with living between England and Australia. And I got to thinking, where is home? You know, where is home when you've moved away from somewhere? So Darling Darling is about lots of different people's stories about how they deal with moving away from where they came from. So I have refugee poems. I have the son of a refugee, his story of him and his father, and his father's flight from Germany. And I have the story of my friend up in the mountains of Java, who was setting up a hydroelectric plant, and how that changed his entire life. So it's several stories, trying to work out, you know, how do we work out where we belong if we've moved for whatever reason? And sometimes, like me, it's a choice of moving, but some people don't have a choice, you know, they're forced and they can't return. So it's quite philosophical, but it's hopefully entertaining too.
When you go back and look at this, let's call it a new career as a one woman show maker.
If you can call a career when you don't make any money, but yeah, that's fine.
Well, it is. It's certainly a calling, isn't it? What's the audience, or what have the audience reactions been, and do they differ from being whoever turns up to the Edinburgh Fringe or whoever turns up in Fremantle or wherever you happen to be?
Actually, the reactions have been exactly the same, whether they're here or in the UK. And the reaction is always that people come and talk to me afterwards and go away talking to each other about things that's come to their mind through the shows.
Yeah.
So they are thought-provoking. And I have seen people sitting in bars 3-4 hours after the show still talking.
Well,
which is great, which is what I want to do, get people to think.
It is, and I think that's how I first got to chat to you, having seen the show.
Yes, probably.
It really does get you thinking about your own life, and that's plainly, as you say, what you want them to do. Did you learn some lessons of your own along the way that surprised you?
What, through doing the shows?
Yeah. Did you, in writing them?
I think what the main surprise I had was, having been a teacher for 38 years, and I did start my teaching career in Hamilton Hill, believe it or not. I was the music teacher in Hamilton Hill.
Right,
in
near
1989,
Fremantle.
Yeah. So having done that for 38 years, I genuinely didn't know how amazing teachers were, and I think that's what I learnt. I know people say this, but it's really important for people to know that, you know, teachers could be earning stacks of money if they went into management or banking or whatever, they could, because all the skills we use as teachers, a lot of people don't have all these skills.
Mm.
But we're totally unrecognised for it. Certainly in the UK, we're totally unrecognised for it.
I think Australian teachers and their unions would say very similar things here. But it is interesting what you say about the skills you learn. You can hold a room. You can have to be well organised. People's skills are good.
Also, teachers write their own curriculum in the UK.
I was going to say, they have to write
it all. So they're writers.
They spend weeks during the summer holidays here getting themselves ready.
Artistic.
Yes.
You know, creative, it's endless.
Well, I was brought up with a father, primary school headmaster, and a sister, excellent primary school teacher, so I have to say all those nice things anyway.
I do want to absolutely plug my In Pursuit, though, because I'm, at the moment, I haven't planned anything, and I'm hoping to get into some libraries and some bookshops, so that's my next project, to get my In Pursuit book. I've brought a load out in a suitcase with me that I don't want to take back in the suitcase. So I've got this fourth show, which I did at Edinburgh last year and I'm doing again. And it's basically, I have a spinner and an audience member can come up and spin.
What's this one called?
This is called In Pursuit Moments in Time.
Well, this is good. So the show's there, you've got the book as well.
Yeah.
But you've turned it into another fringe show.
Yes.
And it's like a game show.
And fairly interactive. So someone comes up and spins, and I have the different chapters written in the sections on the spinner. And whatever chapter it lands on, that's the chapter I read. And then it can be Q&A after the chapter, or even an open discussion. And sometimes I spin, and then I let one of the audience members read the chapter.
Oh, so I like it. Totally interactive.
And then after, the great thing is, I sell the books, hopefully.
So when are Australian audiences going to participate in this?
Well, I haven't got any bookings, so I'm hoping that there's going to be some librarians out there who would like... It's a basically a book reading, but just done in a more sort of fun kind of interactive way.
Oh, well, you'll have to let us know so I can let our listeners know when that's, when that's
happening.
I will do,
once I've sorted
that. That sounds like a lot of fun. And having been to and from Australia over the years, here you are again, a wintering pom. Tell me about the experience. You, plainly you enjoy it. You've got to know Australia, you would say, I'm sure, pretty well. Probably find us, we Australians, are interesting odd bods. But how do you, when you go back to London, how do you describe your time in Australia and Australians?
Well, the problem with being in the UK is that all the people who've never been to Australia, of which there are many, they all tell me it's too far away.
Have I heard
and
that?
And they're not actually very interested in what I have to tell them. But that was the way when I travelled, you went home, nobody wanted to know, so you get used to that. But what I do find is that I don't feel completely at home in either place now, to be honest.
Why don't you feel at home in London?
Well, one of the big reasons is the climate, because we had a beautiful summer. And if it ever got beyond 23 degrees, people were moaning about the heat. So I don't get that. the climate's the big deal, really. And also, it's very indoorsy. You know, people spend a lot of time indoors and they get up very late in the morning if they're retired. It's just a different lifestyle.
And it suits me
better here, to be honest.
But if you don't feel quite at home here, though, as well...
Well, see, if I stayed here for a long period of time, I know I would be homesick because my heart is in London. So.
so it's hard in that sense to be embedded in a place which isn't home when it matters.
For me, it is. I've talked to people who don't have a problem with it at all. They can just, you know, lots of people I talked to who migrated in the 80s from the UK or from Europe. You know, they just didn't seem to have any problem at all. They just settled down here. But I wasn't able to do that. Yeah.
I've quite seriously always admired people who've migrated to Australia. Of course, at different times, economic necessity saw people leaving typically various parts of Europe, southern Europe. Then we went through the different phases. After wars, we had lots of displaced people in Europe after the Second War who then came to Australia. And then again, economic necessity saw people coming. Australia put out a lot of invitations to get people here. Southeast Asia, again, displacement and people being pushed out of places like Vietnam after Australia participated in the war, became important parts of the Australian community. I mean, Australia's become this highly multicultural place, but to come here, to be a migrant, to settle, I think it must be hard at times.
I think there's a lot of people who would have come who didn't have a choice. But what I've learned from writing Darling, Darling, and I really didn't know this, I hadn't thought about it, was that when you're pushed out of your country, not by choice, that's bad. But there's something even worse at the other end, is that you can never go back quite often. And that really stayed with me after writing Darling, Darling, that... I mean, imagine.
No, it's hard, isn't it?
So the place you came from becomes paradise in your mind, but you just can't go back there. Awful.
And you have to hope that the country you find yourself in is welcoming.
Yes, but I mean, even then, it's still not your home, is it?
Still not your home.
I stayed with one of my landlords when I was here in the 80s. He was Latvian. He was older than me, so in the 80s, he was already in his mid to late 50s. And he had come as a young man with his family from Latvia because of the war. And when the wall came down, remember the Berlin Wall came down in the 80s when I was here? And he said to me, you know, the whole reason we're all here is just gone. It's just not there anymore. So we don't know what we're doing now.
You could pack up and go. I know Italian families where mum and dad came as children, but they all... knew and kept going back over the years to their hometown.
Because they could, yeah.
In Italy, could. And then very much later, a bit like you, they'd go home in that sense and live and die in that hometown.
Oh, did they?
Yes, so they were Australian. But
so there we are. So that tells you that you never actually pull your roots up and
yes,
entirely. Yeah. Although my uncle in Brisbane did. He said to me, he could not believe it. He said, you've lived in Australia for 3 years now. He said, how can someone live in Australia and return to England?
Well, I suspect the answer to that and some other questions will all be discovered if you attend, listeners. Darling, darling. Now tell them when it's on and
it's on
what it costs them and where it's happening.
Yeah, Fremantle Lawn Tennis Club, which is on Ellen Street. And it's on the 7th of February at 7 p.m. And from memory, I think it's $20 a ticket.
Well, listeners, you'll see adjacent to all of this a link to the Try Booking, I think it is.
Yep.
And you'll be able to come. Look, don't miss it. Eileen is quite a performer and she does it all with a straight face too. Eileen, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much.